We're speaking with Robert H. Boyle about some of the history of environmentalism on the Hudson and the impact it had on modern-day environmental laws nationally. He has just told us the story of the Storm King Mountain controversy in the mid-60s, which led to the federal law requiring environmental impact statements and gave American citizens standing for the first time to sue in defense of the environment. It is only fair to mention that corporate environmental policies, such as those of the companies mentioned in this program, have changed dramatically since that time. Perhaps this only came as a result of the laws and cases such as Boyle describes, or perhaps because of consumer and stockholder demand as well. But most corporate environmental policy has changed nonetheless for the better. To learn more about anything you hear on this program, visit us at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Coming up on the Hudson River, the Eco Calendar, a soundscape of the river, and more. Next, Boyle tells us about the first award to a citizens group for turning in a polluter. He also recounts a story of how the world's then largest corporation was caught rinsing its tankers of their petroleum residues and then removing fresh water from the Hudson River and bringing it to Aruba.
When the Hudson River Fishermen's Association went after polluters under the Federal Refuse Act, that was a law that was never enforced, and we were the first to enforce it. Passed in 1899, never enforced. Polluters everywhere, and we started to go after them, and it took the U.S. Attorney 3.5 years to move against the New York Central, later Penn Central Railroad, they merged, for dumping oil and sludge and God knows what else directly into the Hudson River every day since the year 1929. The date was right on the pipe. The oil slicks would be out on the river to the extent that you think that the Hudson would catch fire. In fact, even before the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland caught fire, I cautioned people who were out with me on my boat as I was showing them this, don't smoke out here. You can literally set the river on fire. Ducks would drown in the area because the oil would destroy the waterproofing in their feathers. But we printed up through the Morgan Press downriver 30,000 so-called bag of polluter cards in which we put what the law said, that basically the Federal Refuse Act said that thou shalt not put anything into any navigable waters of the United States other than that coming from a city sewer in a liquid state. And that wasn't true at all. There were polluters galore who were flouting that. And it also said that if any polluter who was convicted, you could collect half the fine as a reward. And that's how the Hudson River Fishermen's Association financed itself. No one had ever done that before in the history of the United States. And it took us 3.5 years. The railroad was fined $4,000. Not much, but it's significant to us because the case was a precedent. And we used that $2,000 to go after other polluters. And we gave out 30,000 of these cards up and down the river valley. One of the people who saw the cards was an ecology teacher in the Lakeland School District named John Sedgwick. And he took his class over by Camp Smith, just off to the side of Pigskill. And there, the New York State National Guard was demolishing barracks and just using them to fill in a marsh. And he came to us, he complained, we reported them, and a federal judge ordered the state to remove everything from the marsh that it had dumped there. Among the things that were in the marsh were huge bundles of State Conservation Department leaflets on what citizens could do to save the environment, a dead dog, and a lot of other debris. And I went over there to watch as the bulldozer operator was clearing this stuff all out in compliance with the court decision. And you could see the eels and the killifish running in to recolonize their former homes that had been redeemed. But the guy on the bulldozer said, this is crazy. I said, why? Oh, he said, after I leave this job, I go to over someplace, I don't know where, and there I'm putting stuff into a marsh, and here I'm taking it out.
Let's talk about one of the big money settlements, though, and that is the Exxon tanker and Hudson River fishermen's role in discovering what they were doing.
Well, when we finally came to an agreement with the utilities on the Storm King and other power plant cases on the river, NRDC got back its costs, Scenic Hudson got back its costs, and the Hudson River Fishermen's Association got back $25,000, which we'd never really had before. The money had always gone out to fight the cause. And I had long had the idea of having a river keeper on the Hudson and on other bodies of water across America. There are river keepers in the British Isles who work on privately held trout and salmon streams to see to it that there are no poachers, There are no vermin, that weeds are cut, beats are assigned, etc. And I thought it would be great to have a river keeper on the Hudson in the public interest. And so after we got the $25,000, I resurrected the idea of a river keeper. And I approached a young man named John Cronin, and I said we'd pay him $50 a week. And if need be, I'd pay him out of my own pocket. But we were going to build a boat. We raised the money to build a boat. Andy Maley, now with the sloop, built it over in Kingston. And we launched the boat. And John got a tip that Exxon tankers were anchoring in the Hudson River between Hyde Park and Kingston. And to make a long story short, what would happen is that Exxon, which was then the largest corporation in the world, was sending tankers from the island of Aruba, just off the coast of Venezuela, up to New York, some of them with what they call product, meaning oil or petroleum, from its refinery on the island of Aruba, to unload in New Jersey. And then the ships would come up here and rinse their tanks of their oil residues and discharge them into the river, and then take on fresh water, because Aruba essentially has no fresh water. They had a couple of desalinization plants that weren't working. And Exxon would then take the water, fill up the tankers, I meant they'd be loaded with water, take it back to Aruba, and either use it in their refinery or sell it to the island of Aruba, which had a huge tourist industry. All of this without a permit from New York State, which basically prohibited such a practice unless you had a permit, and also in violation of the Federal Clean Water Act. And I must say that I've never had much of a regard for the United States Coast Guard. The Coast Guard showed up to defend at a state hearing that Maurice Hinchey held, showed up to defend Exxon, saying, well, you know, there really should be a visible sheen on the water. But we had collected samples of the rinsing that these vessels would discharge as they were getting rid of their oil residues before they took on the water. And we took them to Carpenter Associates, a laboratory, and there was xylene, toluene, benzene, and ethylbenzene, all carcinogens. Some of them discharged right near the Port Ewan water intake. The village of Port Ewan drinks the water from the Hudson River. A number of communities do. This was fresh water. It was above the salt line. And so we went after Exxon. It was like the mouse that roared. I hoped that we would collect about $5 million, at least as a penalty, and we wound up, because of interference from the then Conservation Commissioner, Henry Williams, who called it the crime of the century, we wound up getting $500,000, at least half of it we gave away to communities on the river. That left $1.5 million over because the state settled for $2 million. And the state was finally prevailed upon to give that money to what is now called the Hudson River Improvement Fund, which is part of a wing of the Hudson River Foundation for Science and Environmental Research. As I recall, we found out that Exxon had made something like 60 tanker trips in the course of a year and a half to get water from the Hudson River.
From the Almanac, September 24th, 1995. Croton Point, Hudson River Mile 34 through 35. 30 people joined me on a bright and breezy afternoon. Our objective was to observe fall migrants, with the emphasis on monarch butterflies. A year ago, we rejoiced at the glory of monarchs amid sunflowers on the Croton Point landfill. On some days, we saw 50 per hour lazing in the sunshine, waiting for a northerly breeze to boost them across the Tappan Zee en route to Mexico. This year, I had not seen 50 in total. Our reward for the climb was a wonderful view of kestrels, as many as 5 at a time, hunting over the face of the hill, sometimes hovering for long seconds, just 50 yards away from our group. Over the past week, I've observed that these birds seem to be feeding on the wing. Several times today, with bright light and binoculars, I saw the gleam of discarded wings fluttering down the wind. The birds were feeding on dragonflies and butterflies. When we'd had enough of the kestrel aerobatics and taken our fill of the view of the river and the palisades, we left the hill. On our return, we saw a single monarch moseying across the field, visiting blooms of aster and goldenrod. This observation was contributed by Christopher Letts. I'm Sean Anderson.
The Hudson River Almanac is an annual natural history journal compiled from the contributions of over 1,700 volunteers. Links on how to contribute materials or obtain copies are at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu.
Time for the Hudson River Eco Calendar. I'm Jen Logan. A river of experience is what you'll discover at the Hudson River Regional Festival, featuring over 200 years of art, history, and music. Explore the past and present by taking part in a Dutch trading post, watching artisans working in local communities, and traveling along the river to see the views that inspired Thomas Cole and Frederick Church of the Hudson River School of Painting. You can also take in jazz and classical concerts at one of the riverfront communities, visit galleries and art exhibits, or take a leisurely walking tour. For a complete schedule of events, call 1-800-724-1846 or visit www.columbiacountyny.org. The 4th annual Hudson Valley River Ramble, scheduled for the weekends of September 20th and 21st and September 27th and 28th, will feature 125 guided walking, hiking, kayaking, canoeing, and equestrian events, as well as explorations of the Hudson River estuary by boat and on foot. Sponsored by the Hudson River Valley National Heritage Area and the Hudson River Valley Greenway, the Ramble takes place throughout 10 counties from just north of New York City to the Capital District. For a complete Ramble program guide, call 800-453-6665 or visit www.hudsonvalleyramble.com. But if you feel like actually getting out on the river, the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve is sponsoring a series of canoe trips to some of the river's biggest marshes in New York State. Trips include paddles devoted to learning about fish or history, and even an evening paddle. Trips are free and open to the public, though reservations are required. And you needn't have your own boat, as canoes, paddles, and safety gear are all provided. For more information, call the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve at 845-758-7016. That's 845-758-7016. The Hudson Riverama is a new, permanent exhibition at the Hudson River Museum in Yonkers. The 2,500-square-foot installation features recreations of forest, marsh, and estuary ecosystems, live fish, interactive computers, videos, and a 31-foot-long, three-dimensional topographic model of the river valley. An associated 45-minute planetarium show joins two families on an Adirondack hiking trip as they learn about the Hudson's flora and fauna. For more information, 914-963-4550. That's 914-963-4550.
When most people think of the lower Hudson near New York City, waterfalls don't exactly come to mind. But hidden along the river are a number of falls that are formed by tributaries. Among them, Phillips Brook, Popolopen Creek, and Indian Brook. On this week's Hudson River Soundscape, Anaya Lockwood's microphone, as if scanning, moves us across the Englewood Brook Falls, tumbling from the cliffs at Palisades, New York. Thank you. Usually at this point in the program, we announce the content of the upcoming week's program. Like a river, perhaps, all things must have an end, and perhaps this is it. It's the 16th and, as of now, last segment of the Hudson River. Like no other thing I've ever read about rivers, a thought in Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, which I read some 30 years ago, sticks with me to this day. Like a river, all things return. The Hudson River Radio program is produced in association with Vassar College, its Environmental Studies program, and its Journalism Forum. Our student assistant producers are digital editor Sean Anderson and researcher and editor Batsheva Gez. Vassar College professor Randy Cornelius is the project director. I'm your host, Mark Breslov, producer and project manager. This project has been funded in part by a grant from the New York State Environmental Protection Fund through the Hudson River Estuary Program. Special thanks to Fran Dunwell and Steve Stan of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Additional support for this program comes from Vassar College, with thanks to Susan Kuiper. Thanks also to Steve Rath. To listen to this program again or for more information, visit www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Email us at hudsonriver@vassar.edu.
Well, in the evening, baby, when the sun go down, oh, in the evening, baby, when the sun go down, hey, ain't it lonesome, ain't it lonesome, ain't it lonesome, when you're not around,
when the sun go down,
when all the fun is all over, and the liquor's all gone dry. Oh, baby, you get to thinking, a man is born to die. In the evening, when the sun go down,
when the sun go down.
And pals, I'm gone away. I'll be back to see you all again some old rainy day. In the evening, when the sun goes down.